Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. In 2019, Stockton Rush, the CEO of OceanGate, joined us on this program to talk about his plans to make a small fleet of private submersibles available to the public for research and tourism. Included in his plans were trips to see the wreckage of the Titanic in the North Atlantic. It all sounded quite exciting and promising, but then just a few years later, I was shocked and saddened to hear that Rush and four of his paying passengers were lost in what turned out to be the implosion of the Titan submersible en route to the Titanic. Earlier this summer, Gordon Telepin contacted me to see if I wanted to revisit my interview with Rush and talk about the disaster. At first, I was a bit confused because Gordon is a longtime friend of the show who's been on to talk about his passion for chasing and observing total solar eclipses. But Gordon is a man of many talents and interests, and engineering is definitely one of his passions. Recently, he exhaustively researched the U.S. Coast Guard hearings from September of 2024, examining the disaster, and he published them in a book titled Titan, to the Titanic and Back 13 and a Half Times. It's a treasure trove of digestible information that explains what went wrong and why. Gordon Telepin joins us now to talk about it. Gordon Telepin, welcome back to Blue Dot.
Well, thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure to be back on and talk about OceanGate, Stockton Rush, and the Titan submersible.
Well, let me just start here that I never thought we would be talking about this topic, because in the past, you've always been my go-to guy to find out everything I want to know about solar eclipses. So when I got this initial email and you sent me this book, I was kind of surprised, and I'd like to know what got you to go down this rabbit hole, because, you know, reading this book and knowing all the things you're doing, you definitely went down the rabbit hole with us.
Yeah, I found this to be an amazing story, Dave. Now, yeah, you and I have talked about eclipses in depth three times, I think, but you didn't know that one of my other interests really is following engineering tragedies, you know, based on poor engineering decisions. And a little bit of that obviously has to do with my interest in space. So as I became older, I was interested in like why the Apollo 1 fire happened, you know, and engineers make bad decisions because they can't think about every, you know, possible outcome. So like, why would you pressurize a capsule with 100% oxygen? And why would you have the door, the hatch open to the inside? So those are bad decisions that they didn't know about until it became a bad decision, right? And then you have the Challenger accident, you know, with the blow-by of the hot gases through the O-rings. So those are all interesting, but Titan and OceanGate takes it to a new level because you have this personality, you know, of Stockton Rush, who wants to be in the limelight. He wants to talk about it. He wants to talk about the fact that he's designing something new. He tried to get as much media attention, you know, as he could. And then a lot of the cast of characters around him were so interesting, like Tony Nissen, the first director of engineering, and David Lockridge, you know, his pilot from the UK, yeah. So, and then you put the Titanic into the mixture, you put billionaires into the mixture, and then a sub potentially being stuck on the bottom of the ocean, you know, with 3.5 days of oxygen and this multi-day attempt at rescuing. I mean, there's not another tragedy that I can think of that rises to this level of spectacular interest. So I became really interested in it. And with my interest in engineering, started looking at all of the documentation from the Coast Guard hearings and watched the hearings and made up these YouTube videos to teach people about it because there was so much misinformation on the internet, on social media. And then I figured I'd take all that research and write a book so there would be something that people can hold in their hands and thumb through it and reference things. So that's how it all came to be, my other interest besides solar eclipses.
Very interesting, Gordon. And when you started investigating this and going through, you know, all the testimony that happened, we can talk about the hearing here in a moment. What was it that struck you that you really decided this, I'm going to write a book about this? When were the first things that you detected that you saw that were like, this is very different from what I'm seeing on the internet?
Yeah, so some of the early reports before the hearings were carried out by the Coast Guard, you know, there was these rumors that the acrylic viewport was not rated to the depth of the Titanic, but you couldn't get any real information about it. There were reports that the carbon fiber hull, you know, wasn't properly tested or manufactured, but you couldn't get real details about it. So it was just on and on, these little engineering details that until the Coast Guard hearings came out, you didn't have any good information. And then, you know, when was the last time we had a tragedy like this, where basically all of the documentation was an open book for the public to see, you know, because the Coast Guard released almost everything. And then seeing the personalities of the people that testified was just wonderful. And then that's all in the public domain, so you can use it for YouTube videos and clear up all of the misinformation that was, you know, on the internet. And I actually did it officially, Dave. You know, I had to register with the Coast Guard to be what they call an author assistant program. So they knew I was writing the book, and I had to sign some documents. And before the book could get released, they had to review it. So I did it officially, you know, with the Coast Guard. It was great to work with them. And I had a contact at the Coast Guard that I could email and ask questions. And it worked out very well. It was very interesting.
Well, let's talk about Stockton Rush. He appeared on this program, as you're well aware, in 2019 to talk about, you know, these amazing plans to, you know, kind of democratize deep sea exploration with these carbon composite submarines that would be more affordable. Mm-hmm. And allow people to go explore the deep oceans. And as he's said many times, you know, when people think about the oceans, that there's three things that come to mind: whale, sharks, and the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So he knew that, you know, the Titanic was the big draw. Give me your take on what he was like. And if you want to ask me anything based on what you listened to from those interviews, I'd be glad to answer those.
Sure. What I'd like to do is start with the a little bit of the history of OceanGate and let your listeners realize that OceanGate was not started to go to the Titanic. I mean, that's what everybody thinks, but it wasn't. When he started OceanGate in 2009 with his main partner at the time, Guillermo Solein, their concept was a business model to supply subs all around the world to fit this business niche that they thought was underserved. I mean, they wanted to make money. So the bottom line was they wanted five or six subs stationed around the world that could be leased to researchers or oil and gas drilling people or fishery people or oceanographers or whatever. They wanted to lease them and make money on them, because at the time, they would say that there's only four or five or six deep diving subs throughout the world that could go to 4,000 to 6,000 meters. And they were all owned by governments. So, you know, they weren't available to anybody who just wanted to lease them and use them. The problem is, and this is what is not talked about, at the time, Guillermo was with him from 2009 to 2013, and he was the main guy trying to do dives on U.S. coastal waters with their first sub called the Antipodes, a used sub that they bought. And what Guillermo had found was that it was incredibly hard to dive in U.S. coastal waters because of Coast Guard regulations and making all the sector commanders understand what you do with the sub. And the sector commanders in U.S. coastal waters didn't want deep diving subs in their territory.
Why not?
Well, because the Coast Guard doesn't have any real division that takes care of inspecting subs. They're behind the times in understanding the needs of certifying a sub. And in fact, the rules that they use are actually rules that are modified from small surface ships. They're not even developed and written directly worded for subs. So it's a very confusing regulatory atmosphere for subs. The other thing is, when you are going to have paying passengers on a vessel on the surface or in a sub, because they're going to be under the same rules, it kicks in a whole bunch of regulations and safety protocols that OceanGate was never going to be able to meet with a submersible in U.S. coastal waters. So that's why they started this workaround called mission specialists, where people would pay to be on the sub, but they wouldn't call them passengers. They would call them part of the crew helping to finance research done by the sub, even though really it was a passenger going along for the ride. But when they did that, they could go into another category of Coast Guard vessels called oceanographic research vessels. And when you do that, all of those passenger rules go away, you see? But it was still an arduous task to dive in U.S. coastal waters. And you couldn't make enough money doing it if the Coast Guard was not going to let you have paying clients, no matter what you wanted to call them, even if you wanted to call them mission specialists. So Guillermo left in 2013. I think he saw the writing on the wall, although he's never said that publicly that I can find. And then Stockton wanted to forge ahead. So that's when he decided to build his own subs. He knew he couldn't make any money doing, you know, trying to get researchers to pay to dive. So the biggest draw for him to keep OceanGate alive was to go to the Titanic. So the Titanic was the second plan to keep OceanGate going. And I think the reason that Stockton wanted to keep OceanGate going was twofold. I think he did have some genuine interest in research. I think he wanted to be able to pay back the millions of dollars that he had outside people invest in the company. And third, I think he was trying to prove the other owners of the standard submersible companies wrong. You know, the owners that build multi-million dollar subs out of titanium, they were telling him he couldn't do what he was trying to do for a number of years. And I think he just wanted to prove them wrong. And, you know, that's why he forged ahead.
Stockton Rush seemed to me, when I interviewed him and just, you know, listening to him, looking at him, reading a little bit about him, almost like a character out of a novel, almost like not real.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about his background? Because he was a pretty unique individual.
You know, people have beat on me online about this. I mean, I actually think he was an intelligent guy with a good idea. You know, he had an aerospace engineering degree from Princeton. That's not easy to get. That's hard to do. Engineering is hard. Then he had an MBA from University of California. He got his pilot's license early. There's some controversy about what he really did for McDonnell Douglas at the time. I don't know. You know, he comes from a wealthy family. There's all this conspiracy theory stuff about his dad being a member of the Bohemian Club. And he was just driven by, I don't know, a little bit of ego, a little bit of wanting to do something new, a little bit of wanting to be like Elon Musk and Bezos. So it was complex. It really was complex. I don't know what motivated him to do this. And the other thing is, you know, he had built a fiberglass plane and flew it for many, many years. And I think he was just not as adverse to risk taking as other regular people would be. I mean, when you're a pilot flying all the time in basically what's almost an experimental plane at the time, you just have a different risk level.
And it struck me when I was talking to him that, you know, he wanted to be an astronaut. He wanted to go into space as a kid, as, you know, many from his generation did.
That's correct.
And then it kind of dawned on him that that really wasn't the path for him, but that the ocean was this, you know, other, you know, environment very similar to space, very challenging, demanding engineering solutions, and it hasn't really thoroughly been explored. And it seemed to me that, you know, that's where he just decided that's my calling, that's my adventure. But I think anytime you're dealing with somebody like this, there is going to be a certain degree of hubris, and that can often get you into trouble.
Yeah. And no, that's certainly part of it. And you're right. He didn't see his path forward in space and being an astronaut. And you actually had an interesting conversation with him on your show, which I never heard about, which was that he met Pete Conrad, you know, who is the Apollo astronaut. I've actually met Pete Conrad too here in Huntsville, Alabama. But I mean, Stockton met him and Pete said, if you want to become an astronaut, you know, you have to be a pilot first, you know, so he did that. But then going into space, there's so limited people that can get to space, and really the chances of getting to the moon again and getting to Mars is really difficult. And any further than that is really, really difficult. So yeah, he just figured, let's explore the oceans. I mean, there's a lot to learn there. You know, Jacques Cousteau almost went bankrupt trying to explore the oceans too. It's very hard engineering. It's a very unforgiving place, but he wanted to take it on.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Gordon Telepin, author of the new book, Titan, to the Titanic and Back 13 and a Half Times. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with Gordon Telepin and examine what went wrong to cause the Titan submersible to implode, killing five people, including OceanGate CEO Stockton Rush, while en route to the Titanic wreckage at the bottom of the North Atlantic on June 18th of 2023.
Your interview with him was on August 16th, 2019. And, you know, you asked the regular questions about, you know, why he wanted to go to the oceans and being an astronaut and all that stuff. And he talked about all of that very calmly. But what you didn't hear in his conversation was that was a horrible time for him. He had, the first hole had just failed in the Bahamas. So he
didn't bring that up.
He didn't bring that up at all. He didn't bring that up at all. I mean, he was just talking like, yeah, everything was fine. We're going to dive next year. The reason that we couldn't go to the Titanic in 2018 was because the company that was going to supply their support ship, you know, pulled the support ship from them being able to lease. And, you know, you wouldn't have known it at the time, and of course he didn't bring it up, but that was a complete lie. That was made up by OceanGate as the excuse for canceling the expeditions in 2019. You know, he actually thought he could get to the Titanic in 2018, but the sub couldn't get finished in time for that season. And then what happened in the Bahamas, they went down there for testing. The testing was really, really tough. I mean, they only made two or maybe three dives to Titanic depths in a year in the Bahamas. And after the third dive, they noticed a crack in the hull. So they had to stop. I mean, they just had to stop. And on top of that, Tony Nissen, who was the first director of engineering, was looking at the strain data from the hull when they were doing those deep dives. And he was noticing that the hull was flexing way more than the predicted values. So Tony was scared about the hull. And his other employee at the time, Dave Scoville, who later would get promoted to director of engineering when Stockton fired Tony, he was telling Stockton, look, we can't even keep this sub working on a day-to-day basis in the Bahamas because things were breaking every day. He said, if you take this thing to the Titanic, to the North Atlantic, you're never going to make a dive because you can't keep the mechanical stuff working. The first sub, unfortunately, I mean, look, it's a prototype. It was a one-off, but it had a lot of problems. But anyway, the crack in the hull, you know, was the final straw. So they were supposed to ship the Titan from the Caribbean directly to Canada, Newfoundland, and start Titanic dives. That was their plan. But after the crack, they couldn't. They had to ship it back to Washington. They did one little shallow dive in Washington when they got it back there. And your interview is right after that. So, in fact, their shallow dive that they did in Washington was basically, it was a show dive. It was basically to show the media in a way that the sub was still working and to reinforce the fact that they had canceled that year's expedition based on the support ship, you know, being pulled out. But even that dive was a wreck. And that was on August 7th, 2019. And then on August 16th, he comes on your show and he talks like everything's just fine. It's funny in retrospect, but when I listened to your show the first time and after all the research I've done on this, I was astounded. I was just astounded that he could give that interview.
Hmm. It was amazing. He sounded utterly confident.
Absolutely.
And excited to go and, you know, that this is going to happen and it's going to be great and it's going to be safe. Let's talk a bit about the engineering involved here of what are the problems with this material, carbon fiber composite material, compared to the metals normally used in a submersible? Because he's being told left and right from people in the industry that you can't use that material for deep diving.
Right.
And there's reasons for it. And yet he stubbornly keeps pursuing this. What are the problems with carbon fiber?
So there's a couple of things about it. When you build a big titanium sub in a sphere, that is definitely the safest way to dive deep. But it gets very, very heavy, and you have to use a lot of synaptic foam around it to make it buoyant. Because, you know, submersibles don't power themselves down to the bottom. They go down to the bottom just in a free fall because they have extra weight on them. So the goal is to build a sub that is maybe 200 or 300 pounds heavier than neutral buoyancy. You drop down to the bottom, and as you're getting down to the bottom, you drop weight, so you become neutrally buoyant down there, and then you can use your thrusters, you know, to move around. So Stockton was so big on carbon fiber for a couple of reasons. It's much lighter than titanium. And he wanted to build a big sub because titanium spheres, you can only get two or three people in them. And one of Stockton's big things was he didn't like a sphere because you can't take good photography of the people you're traveling with. You can't get far enough away from anybody to get, you know, a wide angle view of anything going on. So he wanted a pill-shaped sub. He wanted a sub that had that elongated shape. So you could have a camera in the back of the sub and you could show people looking through the viewport at the front of the sub having a good time, right? So that was one of his reasons for carbon fiber, to make a big enough sub that could be light enough to be neutral buoyancy, right? Now, the people in the submersible industry were scared about this because carbon fiber is something that's called an anisotropic material, or can be anisotropic, versus metals, which are isotropic. And what that means is, with a titanium hull, if the titanium hull is under great pressure, it will deform a little bit. And if it was under more and more pressure, it would become plastic, it would deform and not be able to bounce back, but it wouldn't immediately break. That's the problem with carbon fiber, or wood for that matter. You know, in my YouTube videos and in my book, I use the example of wood or wood board being like carbon fiber. And it's a good example for people to understand because, you know, you can take a board and you can bend it and it'll bend and it'll bend and it'll bend, but all of a sudden it breaks. It just snaps. And that's what an anisotropic material does. And that's what is dangerous about carbon fiber under those kind of pressures. You know what I mean? So there's no way to carefully predict the breaking point unless you build five or six of these subs at, you know, maybe $1 million a piece, and you put them in a pressure chamber and you test them to failure. If you did that, and you could know that your manufacturing and your fabrication techniques for the carbon fiber was exactly the same from sub to sub to sub, you might have a feeling for when the breakpoint is going to be. But it's really hard to do, very expensive testing. And that's where we get into the fact that Stockton thought that he could monitor the health of the carbon fiber hull by his acoustic monitoring system, which you know he talked a lot about.
Yeah, let's listen to a clip about that from that original show from 2019. Can you put that on, Matt?
We can detect the something that's going wrong with this acoustic monitoring system and then stop the dive. So if you had a case where the sub was damaged in transit or something in the manufacturing was off and it's only showing its signs later, we can detect that because we know that at 1,000 meters it was dead quiet and this next time it wasn't.
Well, Gordon, even with my limited physics and engineering background, my thoughts about this are, because I do understand a bit about, you know, how carbon is different from metal.
Right.
That, yes, you're going to start detecting acoustic signals of, you know, popping strands of carbon fiber, because that's really what they are, isn't it? Just strands of carbon?
That's correct.
Yeah, filaments. And so, you know, okay, some are breaking and you're hearing that. But you can't predict where the point of complete failure is. You know, just because you're hearing some of that doesn't tell you, okay, well, you're fine for another, you know, 400, 500 feet down and greater pressures. You can't predict when the moment of failure is, can you?
No, and that's the problem, Dave. And that's what he would gloss over many, many times and wording it many, many different ways. You also have to understand when he made that statement to you, his experience with this acoustic monitoring system was limited to three 1/3 scale model test vessels that they tested at the University of Washington. So Boeing helped him with the third and fourth test models where they installed acoustic monitoring. So, I mean, those are 1/3 scale models. And the acoustic monitoring, you know, monitoring was showing the cracking fibers. But none of those 1/3 test scale models ever made it to his target, you know, depth to be safe for the Titanic.
They all imploded.
They all imploded too early. One got to about the equivalent of 6,000 PSI, which is just under Titanic pressures. But so it got close. But their target actually was to get to 6,500 PSI because they wanted a safe safety margin. So they never got to that. So he has two test specimens where he has some acoustic data, which is really not helpful at all because it's in 1/3 scale models. Then they install that acoustic monitoring system in the main hull, the version one hull that they take to the Bahamas. You know, in the Bahamas, they do about six dives that are significant, you know, depths. So they did unmanned test dives where they dropped the Titan basically on a fishing line to 1,200 meters, 2,500 meters, and 4,000 meters. And then Stockton did two manned dives to about 2,400 meters and 3,900 meters. And then they did another dive, that famous dive with Carl Stanley aboard, where they got basically down to Titanic depths again. You know, when Carl Stanley talks about the carbon fibers popping and being so loud that it sounded like small caliber gunfire.
Oh, my.
So what's happening is, you know, the carbon fibers are under tension or compression one way or the other, and they're giving, right? They're popping. And then when the carbon fiber pops, you're basically just relying on the plastic or the epoxy matrix around the carbon fiber now to take, you know, to take the strength. The other problem is, you know, Stockton paid Boeing to do a feasibility study to design the basic concepts of this sub. And that was finished in October of 2013. One of the things that Boeing said you basically had to do was when you were laying the carbon fiber filaments down, you had to rotate them around the hole, like in a rotational, like winding. You had to do longitudinal ones along the long axis of the hole, but you also needed plies at 45 degrees to that 0-90 configuration that they talked about. And Stockton didn't do that. And the reason he didn't do that is because his first engineers, which was Spencer Composites, Brian Spencer, I guess they all decided they didn't need the 45 degree plies because they thought a sub, when it's submersed, you know, when under the surface, does not get torsional loading. So they're not going to have like twisting loading. But that wasn't the point of the Boeing recommendation. The point of the Boeing recommendation was if you have breaking fibers, the additional fibers at 45 degrees help you distribute the loads, right? So anyway, Stockton used to talk about the whole seasoning, something called the Kaiser effect. And what he would say is that if you're diving to 1,000 meters and you hear all these fibers breaking, that's fine. They're breaking. They're doing their thing because they were under stress. Well, the next time you dive to 1,000 meters, those fibers have already broken. So they shouldn't break again. And the hole should be more quiet. But again, what he was missing was you don't know how the loads are being distributed to the neighboring fibers when some fibers are breaking. So the acoustic monitoring system could never tell you that you needed to abort a dive.
Which is exactly how he sold it.
That's exactly
as
right.
As a big safety factor.
There's no way he had enough data to understand when acoustic monitoring was going to tell him to abort a dive. And, you know, you interviewed him after the first hole. You had nothing to do with the second hole. But the second hole, you know, that failed or imploded, on dive 80, that was the dive that gave him the acoustic monitoring spike. That was the one that told him he should have stopped, and he didn't. So even when the acoustic monitoring, you know, they got away with the dive, they got to the surface and they heard this big acoustic spike on the second hole, but they still didn't stop. So he didn't even listen to his own data. And what's even more scary about that dive 80 dive is not only did the acoustic monitoring show the spike, his strain gauges showed that something significant had happened to the hull, but yet he continued to dive. And it's amazing.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Gordon Telepin as we examine the tragic implosion of the Titan submersible that was on its way to visit the Titanic in 2023. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with Gordon Telepin. Gordon is the author of the new book, Titan, to the Titanic and back 13 and a half times. It tells the story of the management and engineering hubris from OceanGate CEO Stockton Rush that led to the loss of five lives, including his own, on June 18th, 2023. It's also fascinating to me to think about, you know, these people wanting to go and they're putting their faith in this guy, that he was quite the salesman.
Oh, he was. Yeah.
He had that famous Explorers Club meeting where he, you know, kind of laid all this out there. Could you just talk a bit about the force of his personality?
Well, you heard it. You heard it. I mean, you interviewed him at a low point in the OceanGate saga, but yet, you know, he talked like everything was just going to be fine. In fact, you asked him, you said something to the effect of, so I know, you know, you're canceled this year, but you expect to do it next year. And he said, yes, you know, commandingly, you know, just said yes. But really at the time, he's sitting there going, scratching his head, you know, going, what am I going to do? I've got a hole that's broken. And at the time he was already planning to take that same hole because he was going to try to salvage that hole. He was going to still try to use it. He decided to take it to the Deep Ocean Test Facility in Maryland and, you know, test it in the chamber there. And it was funny, he mentioned that to you in that interview as if that was going to be the continuation of their testing after the Bahamas, you know, that they couldn't do their Titanic dive because the support ship had got pulled and they didn't want to stay in the Bahamas anymore. So we'll do some more testing in the deep ocean test facility. That's the way he made it sound. But it wasn't that at all. He was trying to figure out if that hull was salvageable at all. And it turns out that it wasn't, that when they started to put it in pressure, into pressure in the deep ocean test facility, it was showing a lot of acoustic damage and a lot of strain damage. And they actually halted the tests and derated that hull to 3,000 meters, which actually I think was gracious, but they actually never used it again. And the other thing, you know, the people who dove in 21, 22, and 23 successfully to the Titanic, there was not this information that we all have the benefit of knowing now about how poorly the engineering had been done all through time, right? So they're basically just seeing the glossy advertising paperwork from Stockton and OceanGate and all the well-published social media advertising, and they're not thinking of diving into the details, you know, and even if they did, the details weren't out there to be found. So they were blind to the danger.
There were people working for Stockton that, you know, I know just from what my limited understanding that, you know, they were initially drawn in by his magnetic personality, right, and his confidence and his charisma. And then they would start to realize that they had misgivings about how this was working and his leadership style. Who were some of those people that really stood out to you from your research?
Another great question, Dave. Thank you. So when you listen to the hearings, there are a lot of people online who actually badmouth his first director of engineering, you know, Tony Nissen. But in a weird way, Tony was a great engineer for Stockton, because what Stockton was trying to do, because he came from aerospace, he was trying to justify using aerospace engineering quality to build a sub. And Tony had experience in both. You know, so Tony had experience in the maritime industry. He also had experience in aerospace. In fact, he worked on the solid rocket boosters, helping redesign the joint that, you know, blew through in Challenger. It was way after that, but still, he worked for ATK. So he was perfect for Stockton in a weird way at the time, because he had experience in both fields. So he helped Stockton, and this is not totally wrong on their part. He helped him think that if you're doing engineering by aerospace quality, that it's okay for it to be in a sub. You know what I mean? That those are transferable. And it's really not, but the reason Stockton was doing that was because none of the engineers, I think, in the maritime community would have ever designed this for him. They never would have gone down that path. I mean, they would have pulled the plug, you know, early on. And Stockton did the same thing with the second hull. He didn't hire maritime engineers. He hired carbon fiber experts in the aerospace industry again. You know, once again, trying to say that I can use quality engineering for aerospace and make it make a sub, you know, safe, you know, which is wrong. And after the first hull failed in the Bahamas, Stockton basically blamed it on him, although it wasn't his fault, and, you know, fired him. And then he made another employee who was there, Dan Scoville, be the new director of engineering. Dan's education was in electrical engineering, but he had a lot of experience in the maritime community, but he was not a mechanical engineer and he was not a materials engineer. So he really wasn't cut out to help make the decisions about fabricating the second hull. And when I read through Dan's private testimony, I realize that Stockton treated him just as badly as he treated Tony Nissen, you know, who did testify publicly. And Dan actually couldn't wait to quit, but it ended up that, you know, Stockton just fired him. So he was the second director of engineering, treated just the same. The third director of engineering is interesting, and he testified publicly, was Phil Brooks. But Phil Brooks was a computer science guy. He had nothing to do with any real engineering, but Stockton wanted a figurehead director of engineering. So after he fired Dan Scovill, he made Phil Brooks the director of engineering. And then Phil Brooks quit because he saw the writing on the wall with the financial problems in OceanGate at the end of 2022. At the end of the expeditions of 2022, Stockton was asking employees to forego getting paid because they were so tight on cash flow. And then, you know, then there's the story about David Lockridge, you know, the pilot with a lot of sub experience and ROV experience.
And he had tremendous misgivings.
Yeah, he did. Well, he started off enthusiastic like everybody else, but then just continued to learn and learn and learn what a poor engineering environment it was, you know, and then Stockton fired him just before they went to the Bahamas. So he actually never piloted the first Titan submarine. He was fired before it ever hit the water.
Well, let's go back to the fateful voyage of June 18th, 2023, mm-hmm. when Stockton and four other people lost their lives.
Yeah.
Tell us, can you just briefly tell us, give us a little quick bios of the people who were on that crew?
So, you know, there was P.J. Nargileh was the Titanic expert who's been to the Titanic, I guess, over 30 times. And his story with OceanGate is interesting because he gave credibility to the whole operation. Then there was the father and the son.
Shahzada Dawood and his son Suleiman, who's only 19 years old.
That's right.
Hamish Harding, British
right,
guy.
Right.
And Paul Henri, former French Navy commander. These people all lost their lives too and had put their faith in Stockton Rush and his engineering, which was a bad decision. Can you take us through, you know, take us through what happened up to that fateful moment?
Sure. And a little bit of it starts the season before. So let me go back to, I told you, Dive 80. Dive 80 had a big bang when they were surfacing and strain gauge changes in the hull. But Phil Brooks was the director of engineering at the time. He was the only one on the boat in 2022. And he was an elderly guy, kind of timid. There was no way he was going to have the personality to tell Stockton he couldn't dive anymore, right? So Stockton was making all the decisions. So after Dive 80, they got away with Dive 81, Dive 82, and Dive 83 of that season, and then they stopped. And then what happened is Stockton didn't want to spend the money to ship the Titan back across the country to Washington so they could work on it. So he stored it over the winter in Canada between the 2022 and 2023 seasons outside on the dock where the Horizon Arctic would dock up. And the Titan was subjected to freezing cycles. Now, we all know that when water freezes, it expands and creates damage. And we don't know if there was water intrusion into the carbon fiber or into the joint, the epoxy joint between the titanium rings and the carbon fiber hull. Anyway, that was a huge mistake, a negligent mistake, you know, to do that. So then they did finally get it indoors in February of 2023. So this is before the 2023 season's going to start. And then they decide that they say that the Horizon Arctic was not available again, but I'm not sure if that was true. I think they just wanted too much money. So they leased another ship, the Polar Prince, and they decided to tow the Titan all around the North Atlantic on the LARS, you know, that barge, that launch and recovery barge, all around the North Atlantic for over 3,000 nautical miles, you know, being beat on by the high surf that's up there. So the four dives before dive 88, which was the last dive, all failed because of bad weather. They could not get out to the Titanic site. The Titanic site had weather that was too bad. There's another huge dive that people have to read about, and that's dive 87. This is the dive right before the fatal dive. What happened on this dive, they were diving on the Great Banks, and they had a problem with their variable ballast system. So they had to abort the dive while they were still on the LARS, but submerged. As they were coming back up, the flotation system for the LARS did not work properly. And one of the rear ballast tanks did not blow out its water, so it was heavy in the back. So when it surfaced, the front of the Titan was sticking out of the water on this barge, and the back of the Titan was still in the water. And when the waves would come, since the Titan was secured by pins in the back, it would slam back and forth against the barge. The couple that testified to the Coast Guard said it was bone-jarring slamming of the Titan against the barge for 30 to 45 minutes. And so that was another thing. In addition to the freezing the winter before, this trauma to the Titan certainly could have loosened something or fractured something or weakened something, but yet they ignored it and they just tried to dive on dive 88 and then it imploded.
And just, you know, for folks who are wondering, as we all probably did at the time this was going on, would death have been pretty instantaneous with the five crew members?
Yeah, that's the way I understand it. I mean, when you're under that kind of pressure, I think they were at 3,400 meters or so at the implosion. When it goes quickly. I mean, that's almost, I think, 380 atmospheres of pressure. And so it's just huge. It's just huge. And, you know, that's one of the things that Stockton misunderstood also. You know, in space flight, you build a capsule and you only have to keep one atmosphere of pressure in, right? That's easy to do. It's hard to keep over 300 atmospheres of pressure out. That's the difference between a sub and a space capsule. It's huge engineering, you know, difficulties to make it safe.
He kind of reminded me of the character of Captain Nemo.
Yeah.
From Jules Verne. A little bit out there.
Yeah.
Maybe a little crazy. Do you recall that? I wonder if Matt can play that little clip for
us. Sure.
Well, when I was a kid, I remember being fascinated reading Jules Verne. I'm reading about Captain Nemo and the Nautilus. And you sound like a modern day version of him, only not like crazy like he was.
Yes, hopefully not as crazy and sinister.
You know, I was also just struck by, you know, and I'm not the only one. James Cameron's famously talked about it, the parallels between Titanic and Titan, you know, just, you know, pushing too fast, ignoring warnings, and then, you know, the iceberg and everything. And the other thing is just naming it Titan when, you know, famously there was the story of the ship called the Titan that was published, I think, in 1898, you know, more than a decade before Titanic, that strikes an iceberg despite, you know, warnings. It ignores them and it sinks and it's a tragedy. And it was named the Titan. And it's like, wow, why would you name that sub the Titan?
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. I don't know, Dave. I think that this is going to be talked about for a long time, just as the Titanic continues to be
Certainly.
Talked about. And that's why when I did all that research for my educational YouTube videos, I wanted to put it in a book because my book now really is a reference for the engineering and the decisions that were made that were incorrect. So if people have my book in 5 years from now, you know, they want to look up on the anniversary, it comes up in the news again, and they want to look up, well, what did they do here or what did they do there? At least I feel proud to have published that and have a reference for people to, you know, to search back on some of these details because it's such a complex story.
Yes. And you really did a thorough job and were able to, you know, break it down for us in a way that, you know, the average person like myself can really understand these things. So, and then lastly, Gordon, you know, we talked about the lives lost, but there's also the people that go on that worked for Stockton Rush and Ocean Gate and, you know, how their lives were severely affected by this. Could you maybe give us your perspective on that?
Dave, that's a great point. You know, I've been in touch with some of the people who've worked for Ocean Gate, a mission specialist, and some of the other employees. And people don't realize that many, many dozens of people who worked for Ocean Gate have been impacted by this disaster. It has really hurt some people emotionally, and they're going to have to live with it. So it's more than just the people who died in the accident. There are a lot of people that are still touched by this and have to live with being part of Ocean Gate and the disaster that happened.
Well, thanks, Gordon, and best of luck to you. And hopefully we'll talk about something more inspiring next time. But this was inspiring to talk to you about this just terrible tragedy.
All right. Thank you, Dave. And you did a great job with that interview when you did interview Stockton.
Thanks again to our guest, Gordon Telepin. If you want to learn more in-depth information about the Titan disaster, you can check out his book, Titan, To the Titanic and Back 13 and a Half Times, and visit his YouTube channel, Solar Eclipse Timer. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.